I'd like to welcome you all to today's Press Club lunch. I'm Grant Heading, President of the Club, and I'd like to particularly welcome our guest speaker today, Nick Xenophon, other MPs with us at the lunch, and the Attorney General, Michael Atkinson, when he arrives, shouldn't be too far away, Senator Annette Hurley, Chris Hannah, and Nick Xenophon's new partner in the Legislative Council, Anne Bressington. Also here from our Telstra sponsors, Danny Honan, Regional Managing Director of the Countrywide Central Region. Welcome, Danny. Shortly you'll be enjoying your main course, and then I'll return to formally introduce Nick Xenophon to you, although I'd suggest that most of you know Nick reasonably well. Besides Telstra, I'd like to also acknowledge South Australian Brewing, which has supplied the beers for you to enjoy, and our wine sponsor, of course, Orlando. Now, there are raffle tickets on your table, so please buy up there. For $5, you'll get three tickets and some prizes there on the stage. We have a cordless phone from Telstra, a gift pack from 10, an umbrella there which might come in handy over the next few days by all accounts, and a carton from SA Brewing. At this point, I'd like to ask Richard Green to join me on stage here from Malaysia Airlines, and he's going to make a special presentation. Again, Richard, certainly well known to most of you. Malaysia Airlines is the generous sponsor of the Press Club Scholarship, which we introduced to encourage journalism excellence and recognise outstanding achievement. And I'd certainly like to thank all the journalists who entered for the inaugural scholarship. The Press Club is providing $5,000 to support an overseas study trip or work placement, and Malaysia Airlines is providing a return airfare to a European or Asian city. So I would now like to ask Richard to announce the winner.
Thank you, Grant. Malaysia Airlines is very proud to be part of this and look after the Press Club. And I think today that through Grant you'll see that we've announced some special fares for media people. And Grant will announce that shortly, I'm sure. The winner of this year's Press Club Scholarship is Catherine Crizell. Catherine would like to come up. Catherine is a senior reporter with the York Peninsula Country Times. Judges were impressed by Catherine's ability to break news and present in-depth stories outside the standard country news agenda. She'll further investigate community journalism with the original Big Issue Street magazine in the United Kingdom. Congratulations, Catherine. You have won a ticket with Malaysia Airlines.
Catherine, come here. There's a check there for you
from
the Press Club.
Thank you.
Well done.
Yeah, thank you.
Would you just like to say a few words?
Yeah, all I can say is I won't let anyone down. Journalism is just so close to my heart, and I just wish I'd done it when I was young. But I'm getting an opportunity to do it now, and I'm thrilled. Thank you. And, yeah, I certainly won't let you down. That's all I can say.
Thank you. Congratulations again, Catherine. We'd be asking Catherine to join us at another luncheon later in the year where she'll give us an account of her experiences in the UK when she leaves later in the year. And I'll also, as Richard suggests, give you an idea of some of those rather remarkable fares that Malaysia Airlines has come up for people in the media industry for the next 12 months. I'll give you an idea of those shortly. But for the meantime, please enjoy your meal, and I'll be back shortly. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, please keep eating. I promised Richard that I would mention these very attractive fares that Malaysia Airlines have announced at this function today for those in the media. With Malaysian, you can fly to the UK, for instance, to London for $1,300 return. And that fare is available right through until March next year. And I know most of you, in fact, do travel business class. That's half price, $4,700. So fly Malaysia. Okay, in 1997, a little-known lawyer stood as an independent in the state election on a known Pokies ticket. It had been only 3 years since Pokies had started operating in South Australia, but Nick Xenophon had seen they were already causing severe social hardship. He advocated their abolition or at least a reduction in numbers. Now, a few pundits, I think it's fair to say, gave Nick's campaign a moment's thought, but he won 2.9% of the upper house vote and with preferences became the first independent ever elected to the Legislative Council. And he didn't fail his supporters, eventually gaining government concessions on pokey numbers and speaking out on a range of other issues. He became a shameless self-publicist and the king of the stumps, much to the annoyance of his fellow MPs, and certainly from both major parties. And it was no surprise that at the last election they agreed on really only one thing, and that was the need to get rid of Mr. X. But the March election produced a stunning result, unprecedented in Australian political history. No independent had ever won an astonishing 20.5% of the statewide vote, and that was just over 5% less, would you believe, than the Liberal Party. So despite their best endeavours, he's back. But will such a strong mandate change his maverick ways and alter his political agenda? It will be fascinating to watch. Now, Nick assures me that he won't be quite as lucid when he talks to us today as Peter Lewis was last year. But nonetheless, we look forward to hearing from you, Nick. Nick Xenophon, thank you.
Thank you, Grant, for your kind introduction to the SA Press Club and to the SA Press Club for this invitation. I acknowledge my parliamentary colleagues, the Attorney General, Michael Atkinson, Senator Annette Hurley, Independent MP Chris Hanna, and my running mate and good mate, Anne Bressington, and Mayors John Rich, Fiona Barr, Michael Keenan, members of the media, ladies and gentlemen. I'm always pleasantly surprised when I get invited to speak at any function. I certainly don't take it for granted, because for a few lonely months in the late 1990s, the invitations seemed to dry up, particularly from the business community, and I put that down to a Rex Joy column at the end of 1998 during the heat of the ETSA privatisation debate. G'day, Rex. I genuinely admire Rex. I genuinely admire him. He pumps out lively, provocative columns 7 days a week, week in, week out, unique in this state and possibly in this nation. And in this particular column, Rex listed 10 heroes and 10 villains from around the world. The heroes were predictable enough. They included, for instance, Sir Don Bradman, Mother Teresa, and Andy Thomas. The villains were a motley and varied crew. It included the crooked ex-president Suharto of Indonesia, Brendan Abbott, the notorious postcard bandit, Saddam Hussein, a man now on trial for committing crimes against humanity, and Monica Lewinsky. I'm not sure what she did wrong. Perhaps unlike President Clinton, she inhaled. There was only one South Australian singled out on the list of villains, and that was me. I was sandwiched, so to speak, between Saddam and Monica, between the Butcher of Baghdad and the world's most infamous philatrix. And I was on that list because I didn't support the Olsen government's privatisation of the state's biggest and most treasured asset, ETSA, since John Olsen went to the people at the 1997 election promising not to sell it. And during that debate, I upset our now Consul General to LA and soon New York when I said that when it came to privatisations, John Olsen had the Midas touch. Everything he touched turned to a muffler. I was a villain. I was a villain because I refused to vote to sell Exxon and refused to give legitimacy to a broken promise, and there were many in the business community that felt the state was going to be ruined as a result of my stubbornness. When I read Rex at the crack of dawn, and I was upset, my skin was much thinner then, and I phoned and woke up one of my staff members who had a very dry sense of humour, and I moaned about the column, about me and Saddam and Monica, and his immediate response, which I'll never ever forget, was, "Why, that's outrageous, absolutely outrageous. What's Saddam ever done wrong to be in a list like that?" So, thank you again to the SA Press Club for inviting me. I should acknowledge at the outset that as a lawyer and politician, I belong not to one but two of the most reviled professions in this country. However, I'm seriously considering taking up post-politics, another career, to make it a trifecta of most hated occupations, and of course that's journalism. In fact, just a few months prior to the election, feeling pessimistic about my chances, I approached Graham Archer, the Attorney General's good friend, the executive producer of Today Tonight, for a job, and he knocked me back. He thought I'd lower the tone of the program. This is only the third time I've been at an SA Press Club lunch, the first in 2001 to hear Pauline Hanson, where I engaged in a very public debate, a very public please explain discussion with her as to which of us first knew what xenophobia meant. And then just last year, to hear the then newly appointed DPP Stephen Pallaras QC give me a serve, and he endorsed the warning that his acting predecessor Wendy Abraham QC gave me, that I faced criminal charges for contempt if I continued to make comments over matters arising out of the hit-run death of cyclist Ian Humphrey, comments that were subsequently vindicated, I believe, by Royal Commissioner Gregory James QC. And I'd like to acknowledge the presence here today of Di Gilchrist Humphrey and Graham Humphrey. More about Mr. Pallaras later. I know that I'm standing here for one reason and one reason only, because of the extraordinary statewide support of over 20% of voters, 190,958 South Australians who gave me their first preference vote at the state election just under 7 weeks ago. And I thank each and every of those South Australians who supported me, as well as my brilliant, hard-working campaign team and the almost 2,000 volunteers from all walks of life, from Mount Gambier to Cooper Pedy, who handed out how to vote cards on election day. Thank you. But I also want to give special thanks to the Labor and Liberal parties who preferenced against me on their voting tickets, a blatant indication that they didn't want this pesky, troublesome independent back in Parliament. I witnessed firsthand the community backlash to this approach, with my campaign office receiving literally hundreds upon hundreds of calls, as did the Parliament House switchboard in the lead up to the March 18. Many callers citing the tactics of the major parties as a catalyst for their support and assistance. And the major and minor parties got the campaign's phones running even hotter, with just 4 weeks out from the campaign, when they all decided to have a go at me. In an Advertiser article by Laura Anderson, headed "Knives Out, Mr. X's Tactics Anger Rivals," an unnamed Labor source said, and I quote, "People have a completely different standard for Nick," and went on to say, "Mike Rann and this government get accused of managing media and spin, and we don't play with puppy dogs and toy cars." That comment was 3.5 weeks before I held a press conference with Zorba the Kid Goat on the steps of Parliament House. It was just one goat. A senior Liberal source, unnamed as well, was similarly critical, saying I'd bent the conventions that have been around for a long time. Well, if the conventions are being stuffy and boring, then I plead guilty. I guess that my opponent's attitudes just confirm my Marxist view, that's Groucho, not Karl, that I refuse to belong to any club that would have me as a member. And without sounding too much like my seemingly other political mentor, Woody Allen, I'm acutely aware of going from the burden of being elected in 1997, as Grant said, with just under 3%, the lowest primary vote ever for an upper house MP, to the highest number of votes an independent has ever polled at any election. That's a different kind of burden. It's more onerous, it's exciting and anxiety-provoking all at once, of trying to do the right thing by all those people that supported me. And to keep that trust, I need to never, ever forget why I got into Parliament in the first place. The impact, the devastation that poker machines have caused to so many South Australians. That the concerns that I and others, including my good friend Tim Costello, voiced in 1997, were more than confirmed by the Productivity Commission's landmark report into Australia's gambling industries at the end of 1999, and subsequent independent reports in this state and others. Australians are the world's biggest per capita gamblers, outstripping the number two nation, the United States, by an over 2-to-1 margin, with actual gambling losses in this country approaching $16 billion per year nationally. That's not the amount wagered, the amount lost. There are over 23,000 problem gamblers in this state because of poker machines, each of them affecting or afflicting, on average, the lives of seven others. That's 184,000 South Australians whose lives are in some way worse off from the pokies bug. 184,000, just a shade under 190,958. And the pokies cull of a couple of thousand machines recently, whilst Welcome is only a tiny step in the right direction. Parliament gutted the Independent Gambling Authority's recommendations and intentions of November 2004 when it agreed to give the gambling industry an extraordinary 10-year moratorium on further cuts on the basis that this industry deserved certainty. Imagine if Mitsubishi was assured of that same certainty. There's something obscene about giving certainty to an industry, to a product that has wreaked so much uncertainty, chaos and despair to so many people in our state. And that certainty amendment was moved by then backbencher Paul Kiker, now Minister for Gambling. Day in, day out, I hear the heartbreaking stories speak to those whose lives have been turned upside down by gambling addiction, almost invariably on poker machines. Stories of devastating losses, of losing homes, businesses, families, and most terribly, even lives. And the worst part of my job over the years is to sit down with families who've lost a loved one through a gambling-related suicide where, but for an addiction to poker machines, I'm sure that person would be with us today. Surely that's too high a price to pay for the fool's gold of gambling taxes. So pokies will always be at the core of what I do. The way a government deals with gambling is itself a litmus test of good government. If they're getting that wrong, where else are they going astray? That's why when I hear the Premier boasting that this state has done more than any of the others in terms of getting rid of pokies, I suggest ever so gently that he might be suffering from a case of premature exaltation. I've also incurred the wrath of a number of my parliamentary colleagues because I won't shut up about Polly's perks. How in July 2003, in a little over 24 hours, both Houses of Parliament passed a law to give themselves a brand new, fully fuelled, insured, serviced and maintained car for just $750 a year. That bill sped through Parliament so quickly I'm surprised many of my Liberal and Labor colleagues didn't get whiplash in the process. In the end, there were constitutional problems with that bill, there was a community backlash, and the government, by administrative degree, has given MPs cars on a not-so-generous but still quite favourable basis. And I don't see why I, as an MP, should be part of a super scheme that gives me benefits that are so out of kilter with the rest of the community is entitled to, a super scheme that can cocoon politicians from the economic consequences of their decisions. But there's one perk, and I know this may sound corny, especially to the journalists around here, that for me is the biggest perk that comes with a job, and I wouldn't want to give it up. And that's the privilege of being able to stir things up, to give a voice to people who don't have one, and to empower people to become leaders in their own right on a range of issues, not just gambling. There's a quote from the father of the consumer rights movement, Ralph Nader, who said, "The function of genuine leadership is to produce more leaders, not more followers." It was certainly a privilege, too, that the Reverend Don Owers came to me 3 years ago for help in blowing the whistle on the Anglican Church's failure to act over child sexual abuse. The subsequent inquiry and the report of former Justice Trevor Olson more than vindicated him. It's a privilege to work with asbestos victims and their families and the Asbestos Victims Association in a state that now has the highest per capita rate in the world of the deadliest asbestos cancer, the lung cancer mesothelioma. Laws that were passed late last year with bipartisan support, and thank you, Attorney, to give mesothelioma sufferers such as Melissa Haylock and her young family a fair right to compensation have made this state go from worst to first in assisting victims of asbestos poisoning. And for all the cynicism out there about journalists and politicians, the media played a key role in spurring on us pollies to do the right thing. Gemma Chapman's articles in the Advertiser, Mike Smithson's reports, and as well as all the journalists here, by doing the right thing by asbestos victims of the unforgivable negligence of the James Hardys of this world. When it comes to drugs and drug rehabilitation, this state has had the reputation as a cannabis capital of Australia, with a methamphetamine problem at a crisis level. The UN World Drug Report states that Australia has the highest overall illicit drug use in the Western world, with all the consequence of crime, of violence, of mental illness that it brings, with a prevalence rate of amphetamine use in this country of 4% for those aged 15 and over, being over 40 times higher than that of Sweden, where they have a compassionate, humane and well-funded system of mandatory rehabilitation. That's why I'm so thrilled that drug rehabilitation pioneer Anne Bressington was elected on my ticket. And Anne, I know I promised that you wouldn't get elected, but the electorate broke that promise for me. I'm sorry that John Daly, who's here today, the state's former Valuer General and property tax reform campaigner, got pipped at the post by the preference deals of the major and minor parties. But I don't think there would have been enough tranquilizers strong enough for Treasurer Kevin Foley had John been successful. And on the rights of victims of crime, I've been so moved by those who have come to me for help to make sense of a justice system that leaves them feeling disempowered and totally without justice. Carolyn Watkins, who I think is with us today, whose husband Andrew was knocked down while on a bike in 2001, was dragged 6 kilometres under a vehicle driven by a drunk driver disqualified for life and eventually killed, has told me how the plea bargaining system and justice system have abjectly failed her. Di Gilchrist-Humphrey and Graham Humphrey have also gone through hell in pursuing justice for their husband and brother, Ian Humphrey. And Mr. Polaris's defensiveness over his office, and even his plumbing, particularly in the light of the Kapunda Road Royal Commission, just doesn't sit well with me. Endorsing warnings of criminal charges for contempt for those who reasonably seek answers to important questions, and I'm not the only one who's been warned as I understand it, is an insult to victims and their families. I can't quite fathom why the caution that Mr. Polaris has warned others to exercise is something that doesn't quite seem to apply to him when he himself has commented on a matter currently before the courts. I believe there are some further questions that should be asked over the office of the DPP and the way cases are conducted, and I believe the best person to get those answers could well be Gregory James QC. I welcome the government announcing that it will move for a Victims of Crime Commissioner, a big step in the right direction. I've been calling for the same sort of thing for years. But unless there are powers of meaningful intervention in the courts on behalf of victims during the court process, they will continue to feel abandoned. And I look forward to that parliamentary debate. There's another issue I want to put energy into in the lead up to the next state election, and that's a potentially corrosive role of large political donations on our democracy. Mark Hanna, no relation to Chris, was an American presidential campaign manager, and he said, there are two things that are important in politics. The first is money, and I don't remember the second. Mark Hanna ran the successful US presidential campaign for William McKinley in 1896. I was in the United Kingdom a couple of weeks ago, not at taxpayers' expense, and one of the many scandals engulfing Tony Blair's government is a cash for honours controversy where large donors to Labor were apparently rewarded with a knighthood or even a peerage in the House of Lords. I'm worried about the influence on another type of peer in our state, the Pokies Barons. I see we've got some AHA representatives here. Hi, Hamish. Incredibly wealthy from their licence to print money, and we know that there have been major donors to political parties. We don't know how much they've donated yet to the parties at the last state election. We won't know until next year, but we do know that at the last state, the 2002 state election, it was about $250,000 divided equally between Labor and Liberal. And when I read Craig Bilstein's piece in the Advertiser today as to how cash-strapped the Liberals are, it begs the question whether we need to put on the agenda seriously for the first time in the state the public funding of state election campaigns. But it should be a system that doesn't con the public as the federal system does, where taxpayers forked out $42 million for the last federal campaign, with over another $80 million gleaned from the private, corporate and union coffers. Any reform here should be tied to rigorous and timely disclosure laws, as well as having a strict limit on corporate and union donations if a party or candidate chooses to accept public funding. Because we've just seen that it seems businesses go with a political strength in their donations, and that can't be a good investment in democracy. And with real election finance and disclosure reform, we can help avoid going down the slippery US path where they've got the best democracy that money can buy. It would be remiss of me today if I didn't finish up by reflecting on the Premier's campaign to abolish the Legislative Council, with Plan B to slash the number of members and Plan C to reduce members' terms from 8 years to 4, with a referendum planned to coincide with the 2010 state election. I encourage the debate, I welcome it, giving people a say, and I, for one, cannot accept the justification for 8 year terms in the Upper House. But I reckon the Premier has made a fundamental miscalculation in pushing for the abolition of the Upper House and even reducing its numbers. The cost of running the Legislative Council of members and staff is something in the order of $10 million a year out of a total state budget of $10 billion a year. That's a very small insurance premium to pay against the excesses and abuses of the executive arm of governments of any political persuasion. Veteran investigative journalist Chris Masters shocked the nation with his 1987 Moonlight State Four Corners expose that led to the Fitzgerald Inquiry. He lifted the lid on the excesses and corruption of the Bjelke-Petersen government, unchecked by an upper house absent in that state since 1922. Ironically, while the Premier is spruiking to abolish the upper house, just 2 weeks ago a conference was held in Queensland about restoring to that state a house of review, with all the checks and balances that go with it. That conference heard from leading Queensland academics who argue that Queensland's unicameral legislature exacerbates the winner-takes-all approach endemic in Westminster systems, regardless of which party is in power. Recent royal commissions, external reviews and whistleblowers have highlighted how Queensland's weak unicameral parliamentary system has encouraged a lack of ministerial responsibility, political party dominance in public service appointments, and secrecy in decision-making. And they went on to say, government in Queensland is for major party and big institutional players only. The only independent mechanism for accountability in Queensland, and it's a pale version of what an upper house should and can do, is a criminal justice commission, often blunt and heavy-handed and limited in its approach, and that costs Queensland taxpayers over $30 million a year. Mr. Ann, I don't think South Australians want to follow in Queensland's footsteps, where governments for generations have sidestepped basic principles of accountability. And I don't want South Australia to ever have the potential of becoming Australia's next moonlight state. A few months before he died, I had a long conversation with Don Dunstan about the Legislative Council. This was a man who many believe, and I believe, led a bold reformist government in the 1970s that led the nation implementing a wide range of sweeping changes. And not once during the Dunstan decade did Don's party have the numbers in the upper house. Don told me that he got legislation through by negotiating, by bringing the community with him, and by convincing non-government members through the strength of his arguments and the vision of his ideas. Perhaps if Don's former press secretary, who won't take a cue from his mentor's approach, he could take a clue from the almost 2 in 3 voters who didn't support Labor in the upper house. I believe that South Australians should have a say on important issues via the referendum process, and given the marginal additional cost of putting more questions to the vote, why stop at the upper house? Why not entrust the people with other issues of public importance? If we have had referenda in the past on daylight saving and shopping hours, surely we can have one on the removal of poker machines. Referenda force politicians to explain the issues. The point's been made that people are encouraged to focus their minds on the questions before them, that referenda make the symbolic point that some decisions are too important to be left to politicians, and that people can be trusted to be responsible for their own future as a society. Let's not miss that opportunity in 2010, an unprecedented opportunity to encourage civic participation on issues and ideas that I believe would be good for our democracy, good for our state. if the consequence of that is to lead to a broader, deeper community engagement in the political process, and with it a reduction of cynicism replaced with a sense of empowerment, well, that would be nothing short of a minor political miracle. And on that note, just as I began referring to my co-villain at the outset, Saddam Hussein, for the sake of Middle East balance, I'd like to leave you with the words of the founder of modern Israel, David Ben-Gurion, who said, "Anyone who does not believe in miracles is not a realist." Thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Nick. I'd ask for some questions from the floor. I'm sure there are plenty out there that could be asked. Mr. Bilstein's first in the queue, I think. And if they haven't been collected already, just remember those raffle tickets on the table. You will be drawing it. Great one for stunts, so why not? Barrel girl for a day. Craig, go for it.
Nick, Craig Bilstein from the Advertiser. A couple of probing questions. Firstly,
I wouldn't expect anything less from you, Craig.
Firstly, given that almost 200 South Australians voted for you, how can you suggest to us now that with Anne's election as your co-partner, that you're not going to caucus with her, that you don't expect her to vote with you, and that she can have an entirely separate platform and voting procedure to that you're going to adopt?
Well,
secondly, we've noticed in a number of other states, and in particular Victoria, where they have an election in November, a very anti-pokie lobby emerging. Are you now advising candidates in other states about your successes, how to go about campaigning, and trying to enlist a nationwide group of anti-gambling, anti-pokie campaigners? And very quickly, thirdly, given that you and Anne are now part of a team, does that mean the amount of squid that you offer at your Christmas party each year at Henley Beach is going to double this year?
Can I answer the first? It's octopus. Can I answer the third question first? It's octopus. And I think we depleted South Australia's supply at the last barbecue. I think Mike Smithson ate most of it. I don't know about that. I think there'll be enough for everyone at the next Christmas party. In relation to the first question, Anne had a high community profile as a drug rehabilitation reform campaigner before she reluctantly stood on my ticket. She knows about the pain of what it means to lose someone to drug addiction, and she's worked tirelessly for a number of years, over a decade, in helping people get off drugs through a drug rehabilitation program, which is nationally acknowledged and has received state and federal funding. So the position with Anne is that she's an independent. We don't have a caucus, we don't have party discipline. Anne and I happen to agree on the two key issues, and that's on pokies. Anne used to work in a gaming room a number of years ago, and she's seen firsthand what pokies can do to people. And on the issue of drug rehab reform, I was doing press conferences and putting out media releases, supporting Anne in her fight to keep funding for the great work that she does. So I'm sure we'll be voting together, just as I vote together with Liberal and Labor and my crossbench colleagues on a number of issues. But it won't be a voting bloc. But on those two key issues, you can expect us to vote together. In relation to the issue of other candidates, obviously, if they ring me up and ask me a few questions, I'm happy to answer that, and I hope they go well. If they're genuine, if they're sincere, if they mean what they say about the damage caused by pokies, then if they manage to get up in another state, that's just terrific. It just increases the push for gambling law reform across the country. Sorry? Anne's there. She's put her hand up there in the corner. Okay.
Questions there, please.
Oh, I'm in trouble now.
I'm thinking about the questions I get here.
Rex Jury from the Advertiser. After your success in the last election, were there any overtures to you and to Anne to form a loose coalition with either of the major parties to seduce you into supporting them on a broad general basis in any votes in the upper house?
No. I think people know better. I think people on both sides know better by now. So, well, with me, I think Anne's almost as stubborn as I am on a whole range of things.
So there was no approach, or did you knock it back?
No approach. There was no approach. I mean, other than that the major parties want to have a cordial relationship with us, and I speak to Mick Atkinson quite often on issues, which I welcome. So other than what's been going on for years, where we just kept briefed of what the government and the opposition is doing, nothing in terms of a coalition. No white cars and no ministries in the offing.
Did you buy a car, incidentally? Did you buy a car in the $7,000 offer?
No. I wouldn't. My three-cylinder car is on its last legs, but I'll be getting something privately, not through the taxpayer scheme.
Nick, one thing you might answer. How do you explain such a phenomenal vote? I mean, 20%. I mean, you must have been absolutely blown away yourself. How do you explain that?
I think it was the puppet ad that many, some of you may have seen with the puppet ad. I don't know, for those of you that saw it. I don't know. I just think, I don't want to overanalyze these things. I'll get too neurotic like Woody Allen. It just happened, and I was surprised, and I don't expect it will ever be repeated again. But I don't know. That's for others to judge. That's for the Dean Yenches and Hayden Mannings of this world to scratch their heads about.
Yes, Dean Dowling, Atheist Foundation of Australia and retired physics. Now, what worries me about is your drug laws, the criminogenesis is a word which describes the drug laws now, that is unjust lying laws which create real crime, police corruption as Victoria and so on. Now, let's have a look at the effects of schizophrenia. The schizophrenia rate in most countries is about 1%. In New York, London and India, the starting up rate of new drug or schizophrenia cases is about the same.
Sorry, there are others waiting to question. Can you just pose a question, please?
Well, how do you justify your lying, hypocritical, unjust drug laws, which you hope to introduce, like Sweden?
It's like, when did you stop beating your wife, isn't it? I think there's going to be a robust debate. Anne will be introducing legislation on drug rehab, and Dean, if you bother to read what Anne said in her inaugural speech, her maiden speech a couple of days ago, she's not about criminalisation. She is about helping people whose lives have been destroyed by drug addiction in terms of appropriate, humane, and well-funded rehabilitation. And I welcome your participation in the debate that I'm sure will ensue in the coming months.
I'll send you my stuff to you.
Hi, Nick. Tori from the Advertiser. You demurred on explaining the Xenophon phenomenon as such, but could you pinpoint why you think people have turned away from those major parties to you and to Family First?
Well, it wasn't just Family First. I think Family First got a similar vote to the Greens. So, the Green Democrat vote, if you like, on the left of politics, was about the same as Family First. And I think my vote was about four times higher than Family First in any event. I just think it shows that, I think people do vote differently in the upper house. They do so quite deliberately. About 80% of people voted for the major parties in the lower house, only 62% in the lower house, in the upper house. And I know that when the Advertiser's poll came out 2 or 3 weeks before the election, predicting, I think they were within 1% of that, Anthony Green, said the Advertiser poll had to be wrong. The Tizer was pretty well spot on that. And I just think people appreciate the difference between the two houses. They want to have that balance of power shared by crossbenchers. And I think that's a good thing in a democracy.
Greg Kelton from the Advertiser, Nick. How are you? Congratulations on being the best political stunt maestro I've ever come across in 35 years of covering politics.
I'll try not to let you down, Greg, in the coming 8 years.
One of the major issues that is now facing you is that you are now probably the most influential upper house politician in South Australia's history. Now, people are going to expect from you statements on how you approach certain issues. Now, so far you've adopted only sort of no pokies and asbestos and things like that. Now, the people, I've just jotted down a few notes here, surely the people now want to know what your policies are on issues such as taxation, budget management, shopping hours, cannabis expiation fees, industrial laws, hospital waiting lists, tramline extensions, liquor licensing changes, funding for private schools, and the list goes on. And I think they expect you to make an announcement before the issue arises rather than jumping in after the issue arises.
Greg, I'm not the alternative government. I don't pretend to be. I don't have the resources. I'm still waiting for Kevin Foley to give consideration to the issue of further resources. I've got two full-time staff and a trainee who just work their guts out. And when the Parliament House switchboard tells me that my office gets more calls through the switchboard than all the other MPs in the upper house combined, so we're just in an impossible situation resources-wise. And I don't necessarily expect that Kevin's going to give me anything more, because I told him that if I do get more resources, it means I can give him more, the government, more stick, and I don't think that sat well with him. I see your point, but I guess if it gets to the stage where I'm pretending to be the alternative government, I'm not. I'm not going to run, not interested in running candidates in the lower house. So I was very happy to support Chris Hannah, who I've worked with, who I preferred way above the Labor and Liberal candidates. It's great that Chris got back in, and because I know that Chris and I will work together on bills in both houses that either of us will be introducing. So I guess the issue there is that I've got an obligation to tell people where I stand on issues as they arise. Obviously, I'll be pushing my own agenda, such as election funding, industrial laws, industrial manslaughter. But I guess the issue for me is that I've got an obligation, as do all the other crossbenchers, to conscientiously deal with issues when they come before the upper house. So I don't know if I want to be burning a lot of energy, mental energy, with my limited resources on an issue when it's going to sail through Parliament with both houses, apart from some core issues. So I guess the question of resources, if Kevin decides to give me a couple of extra staffers, that may well change.
Nick, Alan Murrell from 10 News. You talk about Greg James being a perfect person to look further into the justice system. What sort of powers are you talking about, a royal commission, and the issues that you're talking about that need to be looked at within the justice system? What are you looking to be inquired into?
Well, I think that and I've got to be a little bit careful because of a matter that's before the courts, but I thought the Kapunda Royal Rural Commission was a very useful exercise, and the attorney and the premier need to be congratulated on the choice of Gregory James. I hadn't heard of him, but I think anyone who observed that Royal Commission, who read his findings, found that he just did a very thorough and impartial and very fair job. And I think there are some questions about the whole prosecutorial system, the way victims are treated, and I guess at the end of the day, I think Gregory James, who's looked at that already, may well have a further role to look at the way our system of prosecution works and how that can be further fine-tuned or further reformed to assist victims, because I think victims aren't getting a fair say in the current system.
Anne Jenkins, I'm a freelance writer. I'd like to ask you a question on the behalf of local communities. It's about the state government's proposed sustainable development bill.
Sorry, say again.
It's about the state government's proposed sustainable...
Right.
It's called the Sustainable Development Bill.
Yeah.
Now, there's considerable community concern at the prospect of elected councillors on these development assessment panels being replaced by state government appointees. Now, what we'd like to know is who will defend the public interest if unelected members dominate development assessment panels, as this bill proposes? Such appointees wouldn't be accountable to the local community. Now, do you believe in this loss of local democracy? And how will you be voting on this bill?
I know that Mayor John Rich from the Local Government Association wants to meet with me on that, and I'm more than happy to meet with them. That bill was introduced in Parliament just a few days ago. And my first inclination is that I think you need to be careful if you're diluting local representation, but I also think there need to be a number of other reforms so that the character of our suburbs, such as Unley, which we've seen the Tuscan villas going up or the duplexes, I don't know if that's a good thing for the character of our suburbs. So I'll be looking at that issue in the broader context of what it means to preserve the character of some of our unique suburbs. So,
well, I'm from Norwood Payne and St. Peter's, and there's been a big row going on there about heritage. And
sure, and I've got some amendments I'll be introducing. I know that the Mayor Breer, who actually wrote a letter late last year, he was quite sympathetic to some of the concepts I was trying to introduce. So I think I'll be sitting down with the LGA for some lengthy talks and also with community groups in the next week or so.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. CJ, we have the address and reply where you speak to the Governor's speech. Now, obviously, for people such as Anne, for new members of Parliament, that's their opportunity to make their maiden speech or inaugural speech to be politically correct. And I think that's quite valuable. But I just wonder, I don't think I've made an address and reply speech for about 7 years. So I wonder about the time spent on that. I wonder about some of the way we conduct our business in the Chamber. I think having motions congratulating footballers or ex-footballers in Parliament, I really scratch my head about those, but some would say that Parliament's got a role in that. But they're the sorts of things that I don't weigh into to add to the time.
But, I mean, what issues... Okay, for example, what issues are coming to you at the moment? With your profile, you've been seen as wading through metres and yards and...
Sometimes if it's an issue that I think local MPs can handle, if it's a dispute about a neighbourhood dispute about fencing or dogs, then I'll try and handball that to my local colleagues, although Jack Snelling, the Speaker, told me with relish that he does handball issues to me all the time. I thanked him profusely for that. Look, it just depends. I mean, it's not as though issues aren't important. It's just a question of what the resources I have and the priorities I can give to something. Otherwise, I just spread myself and my staff will spread themselves too thin.
Barry Barrett, public relations and freelance journalism. I've knocked around the most continents of the world and pretty rough places, and I'm a pretty rough character. But at no time in my life, and I don't know whether I should be disappointed or otherwise about this, have I ever been offered drugs. Yet my grandchildren in state and private schools say, "Gramps, if you want drugs, we can get them for you." Now, this is a fact of life, and it really is terrifying. And is this something that we should now accept as being normal, that kids can get drugs in our schools, or if not, what is the government or the leader in Australia, which is yourself, South Australia, going to do about that?
Well, maybe you don't get off the drugs because you look like an undercover policeman, I don't know. But Anne Bressington will be speaking out on this, and I'll be following her lead on this. But the fact that the UN World Drug Report says that our prevalence rate for, say, cannabis use is 15 times higher than Sweden, that ecstasy use is the highest in the Western world. I think they're causes for concern, particularly when people such as Jonathan Phillips, Dr. Phillips, the former head of mental health in state, has told me that close to 70% of admissions to emergency admissions for psychotic behaviour in psychiatric hospitals or in psychiatric wards of hospitals are due to amphetamine or other illicit drug use, and I think it's a real issue. So I'd like to think that there's going to be a bipartisan debate. I was really encouraged by the comments that, I hope Nick Angster doesn't mind me saying this, that it's a genuine concern that he has. The opposition, Rob Lucas in the upper house, has spoke about Anne's agenda. I'd like to think there'll be some bipartisan support. If at the very least we put more money into rehabilitation to give help to those who are desperate to get off drugs, rather than having them on methadone for heroin addicts, for instance, for 10, 20 years, whereas in Sweden it's a short-term step to getting off drugs totally, then I think that will be a good thing, and Anne will be leading the charge on that.
Thank you. In the next election for the upper house, I think I'll stand as a candidate for Rugby Schools. Thank you.
Okay.
Hi, Lucy Hood from the Advertiser. I was just wondering, what is the major issue you'll be focusing on in the coming months, and what stunt do you have planned for that?
Unfortunately, when it comes to stunts, unfortunately, it just sort of come to me. I know that Connie, who works in my office, has got a Connie Benares, who's got a law degree. I had to send her out a couple of weeks ago to find a blow-up shark. A blow-up shark to do with ATMs, and unfortunately the shark looked too friendly, so I had to sort of text her some teeth in it. So that's what her law degree has led to, finding rubber sharks in Clark rubber stores. I can't explain the stunt, so I don't know. I'm sure that someone can psychoanalyze it, but in terms of what I'll be looking at, obviously gambling, there's a whole range of things. I mean, one reform that Kevin Foley and others have said we need to have is to increase the gambling age for lottery, for Keno and Scratchies from 16 to 18. I'm hoping that the government and the opposition will come on board for that. I'll be plugging away on a whole range of gambling issues, but of course there's further reforms in asbestos on victims of crime. I've got a bill that I hope to introduce in the not too distant future to further the debate. And of course I'll be supporting Anne on drug rehabilitation, which I think is a major issue.
Well, so you've been criticised for being populist. Do you think now that you succeeded, you know, you got such a big vote, do you think you will lay off on trying to get your face in the media and using these...
Oh, look, I don't think I can help myself, so...
Thank you.
Uh-oh.
As the oracle that you've been painted today, who's going to win on Saturday night?
I've got to say, I'm a Port supporter. My son's a Crows supporter, but Rex, I once met a bloke who came up to me who I thought was one of your journalists, Anthony King, because he had a little goatee beard, and he came up to me and said, "G'day, Nick, Mark Rusciutto." I didn't know who the hell Mark Rusciutto was, so we had this embarrassing conversation for a couple of minutes until when I told my son about it, he just called me an idiot for not knowing. So I'm not big on football.
Chris Hannah, you know me, Nick. What do you think is the difference in principle between those business proprietors who derive their profits from gaming machines and those who derive their profits from illicit drugs?
Chris, it's a trick question. You should be a journalist. Look, fact is, I mean, they are allowed to do so by an act of parliament. And I'm not going to go down that path of, you know, comparing...
I can give you some defamation advice if you want.
No, I think it might be too late. But, look, fact is, pokies do cause a lot of damage. Hotels have done very well out of poker machines. They cause a lot of harm to the community. And I think they've had more than a good run. There needs to be, at very least, a significant winding back of the industry. And one of the key findings of the Productivity Commission was that over 40% of pokies losses come from problem gamblers. That's socially unsustainable, and at the very least, I want to work with the Independent Gambling Authority in the Parliament to claw that back significantly. Too many people are being hurt. And then on the issue of drugs, well, the fundamental difference is government doesn't gain tax revenue from it, apart from nicotine, and I think there's more hope to bring about some fundamental reforms in drug rehab that I hope will reduce the impact of drugs, of crime and mental illness in the community.
Thank you very much, Nick. Yes, please put your hands together. I think we can all see what a dull state politics scene we would have without Nick. He has an extraordinary ability to strike a chord with voters and annoy the hell out of his fellow MPs. While we're amused by his stunts, they seem to his fellow politicians, as cheap and shallow. And we can't help but remember the rollover dog, the gravy train, the goat on the steps of Parliament House, playing the violin outside the AHA, and who can forget the golden toilet outside Steve Pallaras's office. So, at the very least, he's the darling, I think, of the media in this town for the time being anyway. Thanks for speaking to us today. Please show your appreciation, and as I said...
Come back, Nick. Come back.
There's some lovely wine here for you. And for one last stump, we do require you to... to be the barrel girl. This would be for the cordless phone from Telstra. We have a was it green C97? Green C97? There we are. Nick, if you come up and get your phone. Next one, we've got a gift pack from 10. Black D43. Black D43. There you go. All that stuff there. And lastly, the beer from SA Brewing. Yep, all that. Yeah, we have a green... C47. Mick Atkinson. The camera's getting a shot of that, I hope. Thanks, Mick. Well, thanks everyone again for attending, particularly Richard Green from Malaysia Airlines, and congratulations once again, Catherine, our inaugural scholarship winner. We'll have another lunch in June, all being well, and our guest on July 14th will be Graham Samuel, the head of the ACCC. That's it for now, and enjoy the rest of the day. Cheers.